Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, our chief of chaplains. And today we're going to be talking about mood disorders. So, yeah, where do we want to start as we talk about mood disorders? Wide open topic.
Yes.
Where would we like to start?
Would you be willing to define it for us, for those that have heard all these different things? What's a good clinical definition for mood disorders?
So moods are our emotional states: happy, sad, depressed, animated, manic. And so it's our emotional state of functioning is what our mood are. Normal mood, and many people don't know this, is not flat. Mm-hmm. Normal mood varies. Yep. From moment to moment through the day, within a window that does not impair function.
Yes.
And it might impair function momentarily, but not sustained. For instance, a person who gets super excited on a good news, and it's just that maybe they won some big award and they're just so ecstatic, they're jumping up and down. Their ability to actually focus on balancing their checkbook at that moment is impaired. But that's very transient, and that's not considered any type of disorder. And likewise, somebody who their boyfriend or girlfriend just broke up with them, goes into a sad, depressed mood, they cry for 2 or 3 days, they might not enjoy normal activities. That is not a mood disorder. Those are normal variations that for a period of time, they don't function quite as well, okay? But normal mood, okay, is a window where you will actually have variations of mood throughout the day, throughout the week, but it doesn't go out of normal functioning for sustained periods of time. Brief little windows, transiently, is still considered within normal mood variation. It's not really considered a disorder if function is not impaired in some way. And then we look at the domains of life, not just how one feels, but how one functions. What we call in psychiatric parlance, neurovegetative symptoms, that is the things that our brain affects that our body does, such as sleep. Does the mood extreme alter sleep in some fashion, such that we oversleep or undersleep, can't sleep for a sustained period of time? Does it alter our appetite so that we overeat or we undereat for a sustained period of time? Is our mental concentration and focus off, where we can't attend, focus, concentrate, problem solve in some way, or it's off and impaired? Is our thoughts, the quality of our thoughts altered such that we begin having more pessimistic and negative thoughts of worthlessness, hopelessness, guilt, suicidal thoughts, homicidal thoughts, or positive, grandiose thoughts that you have abilities and capacities that other people don't have, or paranoid thoughts, I'm being spied on, euphoric thoughts, impulse control problems where you act out in either behaviorally, such as inappropriate relationships or substances or spending. In other words, your function becomes impaired over the course of time. And then depending on the length and the intensity of the dysfunction, then that leads us towards different types of mood disorders. And the different types of mood disorders are things like major depression, which is not a depressed mood. A depressed mood is not a mood disorder. Mm-hmm. So a person who is grieving will have a depressed mood, but many grieving people may not sleep as well, they may not eat as well, but their overall level of function, they can still do the things they need to do, and we understand grief as a normal emotional state to loss as they work through. So they may never actually have a disorder, even though they have a depressed mood. That would be an example.
Yeah.
Okay. But when you have a disorder like major depression, not only is there a depressed mood state, there's alterations in neurobiologic function. We can look at brain scans and we can see that certain brain areas are are not operating in the appropriate way. The part of the brain where you focus and concentrate and think is underactive. So this is one of the reasons people have attention, focus, concentration, and problem-solving problems. The part of the brain where you feel connected to people is underactive. So people feel, even though they still have the loving, supportive family, when they're depressed, they will often feel socially isolated and disconnected. The part of the brain that gives normally a conviction of wrongdoing when you're actually doing something wrong will be overactive. So even though you're not doing anything wrong, you get this conviction of guilt and inadequacy and like you're doing things wrong and you're not. The part of the brain where you experience worry or anxiety or threat, the alarm sorry, will be overactive. So you get the sense of dread and apprehension. The part of the brain where you experience pleasure and joy is unresponsive. So even when good things happen, there's no joy and pleasure in life. So this is when somebody's actually in a clinical state of depression, there's neurobiologic changes that happen. That's major depression. And that is a state of those symptoms that are impairing function over at least a 2-week period or more to actually be diagnosed clinically with major depression. There is something called persistent depressive disorder where you have symptoms, usually not as severe, honestly, as the clinical depression, but they are impairing function. You don't have the energy you used to have. You're not motivated. There's not as much joy. Your sleep is off, and it persists for 2 years or more, and it never goes away. Then there is something called bipolar disorder, and there's two types of bipolar disorder. I don't know if we can get the details of that, but bipolar disorder is they often have depressions. It's not always required. But they do have manic episodes, and that's where they go out, not the depressed side, but the euphoric, grandiose, or irritable side, where they have more energy than normal, less sleep than normal, more rapid thoughts than normal, and it is too much brain activity rather than too little brain activity going on in the manic side of things, and that impairs function. So these are the big landscape of mood disorders.
So when you talk about this, are these things that people are born with, or are they caused by something?
So
I mean, they're calling, like, is the disorder something that's in their biological makeup from birth, or is this something that has to develop because of a cause external to them?
Both.
Okay.
In the sense of there are genetic vulnerabilities that make one vulnerable.
Okay.
But are not directly causal genetic vulnerabilities. Which then means that they have to have certain environmental factors that would then cause the disorder to manifest.
Okay.
Particularly for bipolar.
Yes.
You have to have their genetic constellations. There's no single gene. Hundreds of genes are involved in certain constellations affecting brain structure and brain substrate, gene expression, neurotransmitters, and various other transport molecules and so forth. But if you have that vulnerability, then you get certain environmental factors and you can manifest with bipolar. Major depression, you can also have genetic vulnerability to, which makes it more easier for you to experience it. But I can tell you that that regardless of your genetic constellation, if you have enough environmental hits, any person can develop depression.
Yes.
Well, if they have a sleep disorder, if they have hypothyroidism, if they have nutritional deficiencies, if they have enough trauma in their life, pain, injury, cancers, all kinds of things. There's so many variables that undermine brain function that can lead to the depression phase that anybody can actually have depression if you get enough hits. Some people are more genetically vulnerable or they have depression with very few hits. Whereas other people, they take many more before they end up having the experience of depression.
Yeah, and I want to highlight that difference between bipolar depression and regular depression, where unipolar depression, we call it, right, is can be more environmental. And in some cases, it can be resolved through therapy. But for bipolar depression, it's important that people understand that there's a certain biological element that you can't necessarily get rid of with therapy.
So the data on unipolar depression, and this is how the brain works. I hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to, and you're right, that there's a stronger genetic component to the bipolar piece, and that's what you're trying to make.
Right.
However, that does not mean people with unipolar depression, depending on how frequent and how many times they've had it, do not cause biologic changes in their brain that makes them vulnerable to repeated depressions. The data shows if you have one episode of depression and you've treated it to remission, the likelihood of a second episode, if you've actually made interventions to treat the contributing factors, and there's lots of contributing factors, that the likelihood of a second episode, I think, is around 10%. So you have about a 90% chance of staying well with one episode. Right. With two episodes you've had and you treat to remission, the likelihood of a third episode is about 70%. And with three or more episodes, the likelihood of another episode is 90%. So, and this is because with every episode, you're making changes in the brain that make it more vulnerable to go back into this depressive state. And those are epigenetic changes, changes actually down in the genome, altering how genes are being expressed. And those markers tend to be persistent over time. And the more times you're depressed, the more of your billions of neurons and supporting cells end up with those markers that makes you more vulnerable to future depressions is what we believe is actually happening. And most of the antidepressants we give people cause second messenger activity that make new markers work adjacent to those pathological markers, which turn genes back on that are turned off, that allow proteins to be produced that resolve the depression. Certain forms of therapy will help with that as well, but if you've had enough hits, enough episodes, the therapies alone tend to often not be as effective. Other treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a strong electromagnet that gives pulses of magnetic energy right across the cranium, activating the underactive prefrontal cortex, have been shown to move the circuits back to their non-depressed state and turn these healthy genes back on. And we've been able to sustain people without medication with a single treatment once a month once they're well. And so there are treatments that can do this, but the brain is pliable and changeable. And as we have more of these episodes, we're more vulnerable to future ones.
So since the brain is pliable and changeable, does that mean a person is going to have that mood disorder for the rest of their life, or is it something that they can recover from and not have to worry about?
If it's bipolar disorder, it is, and you've manifested it now, then the genes have basically been flipped on, and you need to understand you have a disorder that will manifest again with either manic or depressive episodes. It's a question of when. And the more episodes you have, the more frequently you have them. And the data shows as a population that bipolar patients, if you put on antidepressant medicines, you often cause them to have more rapid cycling and more mixed episodes. You don't get more mood stability. So the best outcome for most bipolar patients is to put them not on an antidepressant, even if they're in a depressed phase, but to put them on a mood stabilizing agent of some sort. And that's where they get the best long-term wellness. Additionally, though, when we look at factors, when you look at somebody with say, major depression now, not necessarily bipolar, even though there's some overlap, major depression, let's say you diagnose them because of the symptoms and the functional impairments we talked about, and they've had it for more than 2 weeks, so they have a clinical disorder, major depression. If you stop there, you still don't know what's wrong with them. You know they have this disorder, yeah, but you don't know why. And if you don't know why, you don't know how to treat them. Do they have this disorder because they're in a marriage in which they're getting beaten every day? They have this disorder because they have severe hypothyroidism. Do they have this disorder because they're nutritionally deficient of B vitamins? Do they have this disorder because they're vitamin D deficient? Do they have this disorder because they have significant unresolved spiritual problems, or they're under internal conflict, condemnation of God, and unresolved, you know, and haven't repented or forgiven in their life? They have this disorder because they have a really bad lifestyle, don't exercise, and eat lots of junk food, and that actually increases. So studies show that people eat a lot of junk food have a 40% higher rate of depression than people who don't, because they're driving inflammatory factors that cause these cascade of changes in the brain that cause these genes to shut down. So in order to actually help somebody, you have to look at the whole person, and then you have to bring into bear not just antidepressant medicines. There's this very, very superficial thought, and it's promoted, I think, by certain elements that make money in our society, that you can treat this, basically depression, antidepressant medicine. The data shows only about 1 out of 3 people actually have good long-term outcome with medicine. 2 out of 3 don't. And so medicines have a place, and I've known people whose lives were absolutely transformed by medicines, but you don't get the best outcome. And that's why here at Honeylake, we take a holistic approach. We teach the patient, treat them, you know, the 4 domains, biopsychosocial, relational, spiritual. We treat the whole person, and we look at their relationships. Do they need to have internal relationship healing? Do they need to have a lifestyle change, get rid of the inflammatory foods, to get a Mediterranean healthy diet, start exercising, change sleep patterns, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do all these healthy things and the brain responds, in addition to doing the psychotherapies and dealing with the trauma issues and whatever else it might be, and perhaps medication or TMS, and then patients can achieve long-term wellness. Wow.
Yeah. So from your perspectives in the clinical side, like one of the things that a lot of times I see in the clinical experience is people end up coming to get help and treatment when they've experienced something in their life that falls apart in a major way. And that's kind of like the, I got to go get help now. What are the signs to try to mitigate that, to say, I should really go get help at this point? What are some of the signs that I could look at to say, well, this is not normal functioning now, I'm in impaired functioning. What are some of the signs that might point me towards a need to go get help and treatment?
Well, you touched on the impaired functioning part, where it's, is there a primary part of your life that you're just not able to do anymore? Then yes, you need to look elsewhere. Another thing is, are you wanting to hurt yourself? Mm. If you're at a place where this has gotten so bad that you're having a desire to hurt yourself or somebody else, maybe that's a sign that there's something, you need someone else to help you out there. Maybe somebody that can help you figure out what the actual problem is. Because something, Dr. Jennings, you talked about in a wide variety of ways, but just to oversimplify it, is you have to know the problem to know the solution.
Yeah.
And, I think it's great to rely on community. It's important to rely on church support. But at a certain point, if things are really getting to an extreme, it doesn't make you weak to need to go to someone that's a professional to help you out.
And that's well said. Other signs, dysfunctional coping.
Yeah.
Looking and drinking more than normal.
Yep.
Taking more of your prescribed meds than normal.
Yes.
Dysfunctional coping to try to just keep you going. Yeah. Looking to illegal substances to cope.
Yeah,
these are red flags that say, hey, I'm not doing well. And then changing your routines of life and not getting back in them. Transiently, we all get our routines thrown off. We go on vacation or travel, things get thrown off. But then when we come home, we get back into our routines. But getting out of your normal, healthy routines, you're not exercising anymore. You're not getting normal sleep anymore. If you're getting out of your healthy routines and you're not functioning well, then this is a red flag, and you should look at those things as well.
Yeah. So one of the things that I work with patients a lot on, just in just kind of chatting and hanging out, they end up with a frustration, almost a sadness to get their diagnosis, because they feel like this is the rest of my life now and I'm just always going to be broken. How do you guys help people that when they take that, you know, because in my mind, I'm thinking, I got a diagnosis. I know what the problem is. Now I can fix it. But so many times I bump into people that when they finally get a diagnosis, even if they get treatment, they're thinking that I'm messed up, that I'm broken and I have to be broken the rest of my life now. How do you guys help people with that?
You're using the word broken, which is really strong and has a lot of emotion behind it. And right. That reveals to me that there's some preconceptions or assumptions on maybe what a mood disorder diagnosis is, where that person may not have the exact same response if maybe their diagnosis was something like diabetes, where they would have to receive long-term treatment for it. But I think that you're touching on something very relevant, which is there can be some level of grief that you have to go through to recognize the reality of your situation, the reality of the sickness that you've developed, especially if it's something like bipolar, where you will need to have some level of treatment the rest of your life.
I think it's a normal process with any major change in one's being, whether it is coming to a new diagnosis of cancer or diabetes or a mental health problem, that the initial response is no, denial, no.
Yep.
No. Who wants to have a serious medical problem, whether it's a mental health problem, brain problem, or something wrong with the body. So it's often initial process of, oh no, what can I do to fix it? And sometimes with maybe early onset diabetes or something, lifestyle stuff can actually reverse that, and hypertension and so forth. Sometimes it can't. And, you know, the community support you mentioned earlier, that's great. But if somebody actually had hypertension, significant hypertension or diabetes, would they try to treat that by, you know, church support? No. I don't think they would.
No.
I mean, there are a few that go to and get the laying on the hands and the claiming of the miracle, and then they end up in the hospital in diabetic ketoacidosis or having a stroke. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time that doesn't happen. But for most people, they don't go to church support to treat the medical problem. They go to church support to encourage them to stay with their medical treatment, to help them perhaps be encouraged while they're changing their dietary patterns, right, to maybe help their church community join their exercise program so they can lose some weight and help their diabetes and hypertension. But they're not actually asking the church to treat the problem. Is that true when it comes to mental health problems? Do people with their mental health problems sometimes look, not only deny, but maybe look for some type of intervention that isn't going to help them?
Yeah. And that was one of the reasons why I was asking. I was thinking of this idea of the stigma of mental health as opposed to physical health, right? If I you know, tell somebody I got in a real bad wreck, I have surgeries and put my leg in traction, I've got to be in the hospital for 30, 45 days, they're going to send cards and letters and reach out, pouring of support. But so many times when a person comes to get help for their mind, they're afraid to share that because they don't know what the reaction will be. And I think that the faith communities within the church can cause issues with this because there's a certain perception and certain theological views that, oh, if I just have enough faith, then I won't have any problems in life, rather than saying, no, this is actually a actual, you know, disorder I have, and I need to get treatment for it. And I can pray and I can consult, you know, God and seek that, but I also need to recognize that this is something that I have a solution for it if I seek it out.
And do you think that is because there's just ignorance on the part of the churches who would not be supportive, that they just don't understand that this is a physiological illness of the brain and body?
Yes, I agree, yes.
Would you think that's true? And why do you think there's resistance to, maybe I'm making an assumption, let me ask the question first. Is there eagerness to accept a new perspective that mental health problems are biological in nature, not primarily or exclusively, let's say exclusively spiritual sin problems? They're primarily biologic in nature, the vast majority. Do you think there's eagerness to accept that, or do you think there's resistance in the church?
Definitely resistance.
And what would you think the resistance is from? Why would they resist that?
In my experience, it shakes their theological perspective. That they've been either brought up or trained to believe that, like we've talked about before, that I'm receiving a punishment because I did something wrong. And so they're thinking, oh, if you were, you know, the same thing that the disciples asked Jesus, why was this man born blind? Who sinned? And then, so there's a resistance to that, but there's also a resistance to a lot of the theological conditioning they may have had in the spiritual world versus how faith operates, how, you know, the believer's authority, all those kinds of things can come into play. And for them to accept, oh, the thing I've been saying all these years was a spiritual problem, it's actually biological. That would be maybe a certain amount of backtracking to have to say, wow, I was wrong. And that can be very difficult for church leaders to do.
So more questions about affective disorders, also known as mood disorders. What about seasonal affective disorder?
Yeah, so I was wondering about that. Is that something that is just because it's a time of year and it doesn't, you know, does it qualify as a mood disorder? Because you said it's that operational.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well known. And it happens to people in northern latitudes primarily. And it has to do with the fact that the sunlight is important for our, not just body health, but our brain health, and our brains respond to the circadian rhythms driven by the sun. And there is a form of depression that happens seasonally in the winter times that people get. In theory, it mimics in a certain way hibernation, because associated with seasonal affective disorder, seasonal depression, tends to be hypersomnia. People will oversleep, low energy, overeat, and gain weight. And so it's kind of like hibernating in the winter. The brain is responding without the light to let's go. It's time to sleep the winter through, so to speak. And they become very de-energized and often sad and depressed too. It's very treatable with light therapy. This is extremely responsive, 10,000 lux light therapy used for anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes in the morning before 7 a.m. and close to your face, 18 inches or so from your face, and it resolves within 2 to 3 days. It's very quick. Your body responds. Really? The light is actually making molecular changes in the hemoglobin that is circulating in the blood and the retina of the eye, transfuses across venules in the back as the blood drains out of your eye. It goes through venules and the right through the blood-brain barrier into the brain. And so these molecules go right into the brain and have an antidepressant effect. It's very quite profound.
I'm thinking like somebody saying, oh, I've got seasonal affective disorder. It's time to go back to my therapist, back to my doctor, get my prescription renewed. And you're just saying, I can just get some more light. And
you can get some more light. And it needs to be, you know, you'll need to probably purchase, I think they're $25, $50, a 10,000 lux light. Now, let me give a caveat about this. It's dose dependent. Too much light in the morning can make it hard to fall asleep at night.
Oh, okay.
Too much light can make somebody agitated, anxious, jittery. And if you're a bipolar patient, light can actually flip you into a full manic episode. So,
bipolar, so people don't just need to go online and buy a light therapy.
No, bipolar patients, I've treated some bipolar patients with light, and I have a few bipolar patients that were severely depressed. They also have full-blown, very bad manic episodes, and they do 3 minutes of light in the morning and with their mood stabilizer. But more than that, they'll flip into mania. So you have to be very careful with the light if you have vulnerabilities to bipolar disorder. But no, light therapy, and that's without meds. If it's unipolar seasonal depression, then you know people usually start it in the fall, somewhere around September, use it till around the end of April. Mm-hmm. And if they're in northern latitudes, don't need it through the summer months.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Yep. And we've just talked about a lot of things. Something I really want people to hear is that there are different types of depression and you need to know what's going on to know the solution.
But can I go to WebMD and like do a quiz online?
Well, I say that because we just talked about a risk of light therapy. I know that there are people that are going to say, well, I'm depressed. I'm going to go get this. But it's really important that you're getting help from people that know what they're doing. Because if you have something like bipolar, that's kind of a risk that you're taking. And this stuff is serious. This can have really serious implications on your life.
Well, that's very well said. Very well said. And so, and then there are mood that are not mood disorders, but people who have certain personality structures that can't regulate their moods.
Yeah.
But they don't have persistent depressions or persistent manias. They are just extremely moody people to the point of being dysfunctional in their day-to-day operations. They're impulsive. They will lash out. They have anger, rage moods, and so forth. These aren't considered mood disorders, not bipolar, not depression. It's a form of various types of personality disorders, but they don't modulate or regulate their moods very well. These disorders, medicines will mitigate some of the intensity, but will not resolve. These disorders are resolved best by psychotherapies.
Yes.
Getting in and in dealing with the typically unresolved trauma, internal belief systems, self-perception systems, identity, who am I, who are others, trust issues. There's a lot of other psycho-spiritual elements involved that drives this type of moodiness. And these individuals are often ones who cause significant disruptions in organizations and families and draw lots of attention and will often be misdiagnosed by novice diagnosticians as bipolar because their moods are constantly swinging. But their moods will swing in the moment, in several mood swings in a day or from day to day, but not sustained elevations or sustained depressions.
Yep, absolutely.
Any other questions or things you want to talk about?
We've talked about some of the things, and this may be too broad to look into, but we've talked about some of the biochemical things that are going on in the body and how you would treat that. Are there certain specific therapies, like psychotherapies, that actually treat mood disorders better than others that you found?
Cognitive therapy has been shown to be effective in treating depression. There's no therapy that is effective in treating bipolar disorder. There are therapies that can be effective in helping bipolar disorders come to terms and acceptance of their disorder so they'll participate in the treatment. But if you have bipolar 1 disorder, you actually are going to need medication for mood stabilization the rest of your life, basically.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So, but cognitive therapy is a classic that has been well validated for the treatment of depression. That's a truth-based therapy. And this therapy helps reconnect the various neural circuits and networks that are disrupted in depression.
Mm. That's good stuff. So if they're looking for a clinician to treat them, that's the kind of therapies they should probably be looking for that person would be able to offer them.
Sure.
Well, this goes back to you have to know the problem to know the solution.
That's right.
And if you're having depression because you have childhood wounding or you have trauma or you have different stuff like that, then you need to be going to a therapist that knows how to work with those specific issues and knows how to challenge you and bring truth.
So we've got a family and they recognize that one of their family members has been diagnosed and they've got their treatment options and all these things. What can family members do to support their loved one that now has a mood disorder diagnosed?
I mean, support is the key word there that you said, right? Just encouraging them to continue doing what they've been prescribed, what they've been assigned to do, encouraging them to stay in therapy, stay getting whatever support that they need. What I want to caution families to do is to take on the role of therapist or clinician themselves. It can be really hard to see a family member struggle in this way, but it's not your responsibility to fix that family member.
Well said. Well said. So first, we're making an assumption in your question that the individual with depression accepts the fact they have depression and they're actually seeking treatment.
Right.
With that assumption, then family members can be supportive by not bringing in the fake or false religious condemnation, not bringing in distorted ideas that if you had more faith, you wouldn't need your medicine. Because we have many family members who do very well with the treatment, but then their husband, their parents tell them that if they had more faith, they wouldn't need it, and they're put under tremendous pressure to stop the therapeutic interventions that are actually getting them well. So families can be supportive by educating themselves and going to school, asking to go visit with the therapist or the psychiatrist and be educated on what is actually the going on with my loved one, so you can understand what depression actually is. And then be able to be supportive that way. There are sometimes things that can be done depending on the contributing factors. For instance, some people have really bad nutrition. And so if it's your husband has depression and you cook 70% of the meals, learning how to cook more Mediterranean style, which is anti-inflammatory, and studies show that people who eat Mediterranean diet have less depression than people who eat fast food, junk food, typical American diet. So you could support moving the home toward a more healthy, if that's your role in the home. So there are a lot of things you can do if you educate yourself on what the problem is that can be helpful. But what about the case in which you have a family member who you recognize has depression, but they're in denial and they won't get help, and they're you know, basically a very, you know, Debbie Downer. They have real problems because of the depression, and they're gloomy and down all the time. Well, what do you do? How do you handle that? Well, you empathize first. Sorry, you're down. You express the fact that you'd fix it if you could, as long as you always end with, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'd fix this for you if I could, but I can't. Would you like to get some help?
Right.
And ask them, make them make a decision. Are you tired of being miserable? Are you tired of being depressed? Are you tired of all this? Well, let's get you real help for this. Let's go see your doctor. Let's see if make sure there's not a thyroid problem. Let's make sure there's not a testosterone problem. Let's make sure there's not a sleep disorder, untreated sleep apnea. Let's make sure. And most people, when they recognize there could be a physical explanation, are willing to go at least that portion of the exam. And then they can evaluate the other elements. And if you get in with a good mental health provider, they can give you explanations on other contributing factors like the lifestyle factors, diet, exercise, et cetera, that can be factors that if are addressed. But ultimately, going down the trail of helping them recognize that they don't have to live this way and there are real treatment options that could help them if they would want to get into it, and then be supportive of those options.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys. This has been really helpful for somebody that's a novice in the field. I appreciate it. This has been really good.
Well, thank you for joining us today. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.